Mary, can I ask about like energy saving just in your own house, in your own life? What do you do?
I take a bus all the time now into Trinity.
Do you really?
I do. And I did a terrible thing recently. I thought I was going to miss the bus, the 46A, and I sneaked in the back of it to go and put my card in the front. And the bus driver said, "You may be a former president, but you can't do that."
Did you?
So I said, "I'll never do it again."
Oh my God. They didn't kick you off the bus?
No, no, but I don't know what the penalty might be. I didn't know I was doing wrong, actually. I was innocent.
Your Honour, I insist. I had no idea. I'd be like, with your legal record, I think we know that you knew what you were doing. That's so funny. So did you start using the bus as an environmental thing?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely.
It wasn't just because you got free travel?
No, but it helps.
Hello, everybody. Well done. You have made it. Welcome to Mothers of Invention. I was the first woman president of Ireland, and now I'm chair of the elders. Oh, wait, that's you, Mary. That's the other host. I'm just the comedian and writer, Maeve Higgins.
And I'm Mary Robinson now. I am not Maeve Higgins. And,
you wish.
And actually now, basically, I spend all my time fighting for climate justice and occasionally host a very popular podcast on feminist solutions to climate change.
Yes, that's us. We're searching high and low to bring you the most inspiring women and even the odd man who are building, inventing, strategizing and problem solving the climate breakdown. Mary, did you hear our mini-sode on George Monbiot's new and improved vocab about what's happening to climate?
I do think it's important to look at the language we use. I quite often use climate disruption. I also am happy with climate breakdown because I think that really points to the fact that we have endangered our whole ecosystems that sustain us. And that's the existential threat.
I like chaos, but breakdown is good too. Mary, do you want to join the band Dirty Fuels that we came up with in that episode? We proposed a kind of a punk band and I never got a clear answer from you if you're in or out.
Yeah, well, this goes to show I didn't listen to it. I missed it.
Literally the only podcast you listen to is the one you're actually on, even your own series. But if you're not on that, you won't listen to that one.
Exactly, yes. I'm an elder. So this week, we're looking at cities. Half the world's population currently live in cities around the world. But by 2050, that number will increase to almost 70%. And much of that increase will be due to climate migration from rural areas. Despite taking up only 2% of the world's landmass, cities consume over two-thirds of the world's energy and account for more than 70% of global CO2 emissions. We also know that to make any real changes in cities, we have to use a holistic approach, and that means we each have to find our role in the fight for climate justice. Each city also has its own set of challenges. So in today's episode, we're visiting three very different cities around the world and asking this week's mothers how they are using people power, policy and citizen innovation to affect change in their hometowns.
To help us hold down the conversation, we are beaming in our guest host mother, live and direct from India. She's the campaigns director at Purpose Climate Lab India and co-founder of Help Delhi Breathe, a movement rallying for clean air. And she is winning. Richa Upadhyay, welcome to Mothers of Invention.
Thank you so much.
Great to meet you. And Mary is also on the line.
Hi, Richa. I wouldn't like to leave you to Maeve all on her own. She's dangerous, you know.
Richa, can I ask you, have you seen Made in Heaven, that show?
Yes, I have. My friends made it, actually.
Oh my God, I love that show. Mary, if you don't know Made in Heaven, it's this really cool sort of like dramatic comedy that's set in Delhi, and it's about wedding planners, and it is the most beautiful show, and it sort of has a political message too, I guess. I can't believe your friends made that show.
They have. And I've said, please include a narrative around air pollution in Delhi. So let's see what they come up with.
Good. Can somebody send me a link?
I'll send you a link. That's so funny that like you are pressuring them to put in an air pollution storyline.
Like one of the weddings get cancelled because it's too polluted.
Yes, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm glad you like the show. I'll tell my friends.
Oh, yeah, I love it. Also, the guys are so handsome. Jesus Christ.
Maeve.
you were born and raised in Delhi. Is that right?
I was born in India, actually in a state called Punjab. And I grew up a little bit in Kathmandu, but spent a lot of time in Delhi, yeah. But I grew up all over the place. I'm part Canadian, I'm part Nepali. I spent a lot of time in New York. And I've now been living in India for almost 10 years.
Can you tell us about Delhi? Like, I read that it's one of, you know, the more polluted cities in the world.
Delhi has come up as one of the most polluted cities in the world. And the numbers are pretty alarming. There have been times when it's, you know, the pollution is 14, 15, even 20 times higher than the WHO standards.
We have some information about Dublin, where Mary lives and, you know, where we're from. Dublin's pollution is 20% lower than the WHO standard, but still suffers 950 deaths a year from air pollution related illnesses. So it's kind of an extraordinary number.
We're also dealing with a huge number of people now who are dying because of pollution-related illnesses. And I believe the number is somewhere around 1.8 million people. The narrative has reached to a critical point, right? It's not just, oh, our air is bad. It's our air is killing us, literally.
As you can see, there is a thick layer of smog right behind me at Akshardham, New Delhi. And the Central Pollution Control Board has predicted that the air quality is supposed to worsen in the coming days. Central Pollution Control Board has asked people not to go out in the morning and evening.
Is it true that, like, Delhi citizens kind of check the daily air quality levels the way, like, I would check the weather before I go outside? Is that happening there?
Today we are at a point after a lot of hard work by a lot of people where major newspapers will publish data on the front page to remind people that the air is so toxic. And most TV channels, you'll see a ticker on the side that displays the air quality data.
What's a day in the life of a Delhi citizen like? And how have people been coping with the air pollution as they go about their own commute?
Depending on which socioeconomic kind of space that you inhabit, it's very different. So, you know, somebody who kind of lives in an air-conditioned home, goes to work in an air-conditioned car, goes to an air-conditioned mall, their exposure levels, you know, is significantly lower. They can buy air purifiers. There's a whole economy of air pollution that has kind of ballooned up in Delhi. And so for that person, the daily commute is very different from somebody, you know, who works as a street cleaner. Their exposure to air pollution is, you know, 50, 60 times more than the person I was describing before.
I'm glad you bring out the intersection between poverty, class, what you're exposed to, and those who have a lot of ways in which they can minimize the impact of air quality. You know, again, there's an injustice in that, isn't there?
There really, truly is. And even just sort of having that purchasing power to go out and buy a mask for your family, even at 100 rupees, you know, which isn't a whole lot of money, it's a couple of dollars. For somebody who actually makes a couple of dollars per day and has to feed a whole family, that's a huge cost.
Richa, could you explain to our audience what the connections between air pollution and climate change are?
Sure. So air pollution refers to airborne substances and particles infecting the air with consequential harmful effects on the health and well-being of all living things. Air pollution and climate change share the same problem. They're both sort of aggravated by the burning of fossil fuels, which include transportation, industrial processes, burning of forest, aerosol use and radiation.
There's this movie that's like out in the US at the moment. I don't know if it's worldwide yet, Pet Cemetery, where they basically like dig up dead things and reanimate them again. Like it never works out when we just like dig up these dead substances and reanimate them with fire.
Absolutely. Burning of all things is pretty much bad. If you're burning it, you're breathing it. It's a very direct correlation.
Yes.
And where did you begin your venture into climate justice?
You know, I've always believed that one of our greatest fights as a generation is the climate justice fight. But I didn't start out as a climate justice activist at all. In fact, I really started out being involved in the feminist movement in the United States, feminism gave me a way of analysis, of strategic thinking, and of really recognizing the power of movement building. And so I've taken those lessons and I've, you know, done a whole bunch of things, including working in South Sudan. Right when South Sudan was kind of formed as a country, I was in Juba, and, you know, it was in the aftermath of this decade-long conflict, and there was a lot of sexual violence against women that was used as a weapon of war and now was permeating into even peacetime. And then I delved into the post-disaster world, which made me think about disasters generally. Why were they happening? Big storms and floods have happened before in history, but the impact of it was really propelled because of man-made things.
I'm very impressed by the road you traveled, if you like, to come to climate justice and now tackling air pollution in particular. You know, it's given you a very holistic approach, which I like, seeing the intersections between so many things. And in that context, you know, Richa, we are obviously seeing you as a mother of invention. So tell us about Help Delhi Breathe and what kinds of successes you've had with it so far.
So Help Delhi Breathe started as a public mobilization campaign. We wanted to mobilize people through our digital tactics, go out and organize on the streets and take the campaign in phases, where the first phase was perception change. How do we make people think about this problem as a problem? And then once we do that, how do we kind of push for real solutions?
Richa, give us a few of your big ticket ideas.
So one, we're, of course, pushing for the city to do better on public transportation. We've been pushing for electric buses to be on the road. And we've seen this happen in China, where the city has transformed their whole transportation system into electric. And we wanted to push Delhi to do the same. So we recently won our campaign for 1,000 electric buses for Delhi, which we're really, really proud of. Super excited about that.
Wow. That is excellent work, Richa. It's so important. Mm-hmm. It's actually not enough, obviously, on its own. But once people start to see that there is another way, that there is an efficient and a green way to solve transportation pollution, then that makes all the difference. That sort of has a domino effect. Mm-hmm. So what are you working on now?
We've also been looking at energy, because burning dirty fossil fuels is a huge contributor to air pollution. We need emission standards for thermal power plants, but we also need to switch over to clean energy sources. And so the Delhi solar policy was sort of hanging in the air a couple of years ago. And at that time, while there were a lot of champions sort of in the Delhi government who wanted this to happen, there really wasn't a level of impetus that the government needed. And so we kind of went in and mobilized the tuk-tuk drivers, who are called auto rickshaw drivers in Delhi, for them to be the voice of this policy, because they're on the front lines of air pollution. And it worked, and the policy came out, and now we're tirelessly working to make sure folks adopt solar rooftops as their source of energy.
Oh, yes. Congratulations, Richa. This is a lesson that we learned at the Paris Agreement. It's absolutely vital to have those at the front lines of climate crisis in the room, speaking from their own experience. That's what policymakers need to hear, to get them across the line. So good for you, and good for the tuk-tuk drivers, a service to your city. It's also vital to have citizens to take responsibility and move over to solar just as soon as they can.
I don't know if you guys have seen this meme. And yes, I am going to refer to a meme. There's a meme of a huge sumo wrestler and a baby sumo wrestler. And the huge sumo wrestler is sort of the industries, it's the lobbyist. And this baby sumo is your individual choice to be greener. And of course, the baby sumo is amazing and he's, you know, going to grow up to be a big sumo. But right now, we're in this really unequal balance of equation and power.
Maeve, you were pretty close to Extinction Rebellion, as I remember. They've been causing some chaos in London in recent days, but they're showing just how necessary it is to disrupt normal life in order to get attention to climate change. I love the kind of disruption that's going on now, because we need to do it.
Yeah, same here, definitely. Delhi is one of the largest cities in the world, but smaller cities still need to put climate initiatives on the top of their agendas. The capital of Sierra Leone in West Africa, Freetown, has 1.7 million inhabitants, but with its population growing by 4.2% every year, it's projected to reach 2 million people in just 9 years' time.
Sierra Leone has a difficult recent history, a long civil war at the end of the 1990s, and an outbreak of Ebola in 2014, which obviously disrupted every part of society and eventually claimed around 4,000 lives. Today, Freetown has its first elected woman mayor, Yvonne Akisayer, and she's implementing an innovative and women-led approach to sustainability as the city adapts to rapid urbanisation. Happily, we were able to catch up with her at the Women for Climate Summit in Paris, where she was sharing her learnings with other women mayors. So let's listen to her story.
Yvonne Akisayer, mayor of Freetown.
Very often, there's an expectation that women can't do something. So I needed to clarify that you don't need to judge me here as a candidate on the basis of my gender. Judge me on what you're judging all the men on. What have I done? What can I do? What am I capable of doing?
Now to the Ebola crisis, which has claimed more than 5,000 lives out of 13,000 reported cases. Many communities in West Africa, which has borne the brunt of the epidemic, are still completely overwhelmed. This report from Sierra Leone.
Freetown, the capital itself, 1.6 million people now in the grip of Ebola.
During the Ebola outbreak, I stepped forward. When the planes were taking everybody out of Freetown, crazy me, I flew in on the 13th of November 2014. I ended up becoming the director of planning for the national response and was there right till the end, a year later, when the outbreak was declared over on the 7th of November 2015.
Bye-bye, Ebola. We just want to say something to the people then.
As a result of that, I was given medals, blah, blah. But perhaps most significantly, I was asked to lead the post-Ebola recovery, the economic recovery program, as a private consultant to the government.
Ebola mash up the nation. It caused no frustration. Left some family pumping. Put the one who can't keep her skin.
I've worked in the private sector all my life. Everything I've just described has been what I've done on the side, like my voluntary, my charity work. I'm actually a finance professional. But when I came face to face with the absence of policies, systems, processes, but perhaps most significantly, vision, the consequences of that on a city, and as a result, on the environment, I ran for office. My city is in ruins. And it needs somebody who's going to look at it from the perspective of building up, of restoring. The journey started with a love for my country, a love for my people. There is a constant rural drift from the farming communities to the city. There's an anecdotal sense in which it's being driven by climate change, but I don't think we've got the data to support it. That notwithstanding, climate migration is happening. We are receiving a significant number of people into the city every day. The consequence of the rainy season changing, the dry season changing, is affecting women farmers, causing them to relocate to the capital. And that is putting an additional burden on the environment. We've lost over 40% of our vegetation in the city in the last 10 years. That's huge. So women are at the front end of the consequences. But because women are so full of initiatives and always trying to find their solutions, I've got young women who've come to my office who've designed a solar streetlight. And we're going to be actually installing it by the police station as a sample. I talked about the recycling of the plastic bottles, which we're using for paving stones. That company also has women right in the front leadership. I've had women innovators coming up with designs to help children to read where there isn't lighting in their homes. Books where you can put the solar light into your folder. So you're walking around with your own lamp. These are all innovations which not even women, but young women have been approaching me with. I'm a woman. I've gotten involved in politics. I've run for mayor because of the environment and because women are empowered when a woman is in leadership. Women who otherwise wouldn't come forward feel like, oh no, I have an idea. I want to talk to Mary Yvonne about it. And we're working to see how we can support those organizations, support those businesses, support those ideas. In Freetown, when I was campaigning, something I said often is, Mina Kumbra, which in Creole means, I'm a mother. And because I'm a mother, I nurture. One of the images which is always in my mind when I'm thinking about sanitation is a picture of a little girl scavenging in a rubbish dump. That moves me. It keeps me up at night because that could be my child and it's somebody's child. And that makes me determined to ensure that we change her opportunities and her future. It'll happen for young men too, but she's the one that I'm thinking of.
I was very interested to hear Mary Yvonne as a woman mayor, so conscious that climate is forcing people to leave and come to her city. And it's true. I mean, it's true of so many African countries. You know, they sow and then the harvest is destroyed either by long drought or by flooding. And there's no plan B, so they have to just move to the city. What I also liked was the way she sees that women can be full of initiatives.
Richa, are you going to run for the mayor of Delhi? No pressure.
I don't know. It's a lot of work.
You're doing enough. My God, you're doing enough.
I was just going to say that it makes complete sense that a woman is taking on all of these burdens and all of these roles and really leading the way. And we are excellent jugglers of time and workloads. And that's proving to be true more and more.
But you know what I thought was cool as well? Where Mary Yvonne sort of casually mentioned, you know, this isn't even my full-time role. I also work in finance. And I was like, what? But that made me think that I find that here, where I live in New York and also in Ireland, people kind of have this all or nothing attitude where they say, like, what should I do about climate? Should I, like, quit my job in finance and dedicate myself to, you know, working in the humanitarian, in, you know? It's like, no, just do what you can. I mean, obviously, Mary Yvonne is doing exceptional work. But I think I took from that, you can start where you're at. You don't have to change everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you're becoming quite an expert, Maeve. Our final mother of the show's work has taken her from the island of Manhattan to a floating island city in French Polynesia. For 20 years, Claire Mifflin was a green buildings architect designing public spaces in New York City. In mid-career, she began looking into how cities handle their waste and how waste impacts everything from infrastructure to social interactions. Claire recently ran off to study biomimicry, a design philosophy which looks at how systems in nature can help us solve complex human problems. It was there that she realized nature doesn't create any waste. This epiphany inspired her to develop the Zero Waste Design Guidelines for New York City and take her research worldwide. So welcome, Claire.
Thank you, Mary. Glad to be here.
And we've got Richa too. Yeah.
Hi, Claire.
Hi, Richa.
Hi.
Claire, where did you come from today?
Brooklyn.
Oh, perfect.
So right here.
Oh,
okay. I tried out one of these co-working spaces down the road. They use restaurants that are closed during the day and you pay between $25 and $100 a month to just use these spaces that would be empty and unused otherwise.
Right, right. You get free coffee and...
Free coffee, quick Wi-Fi.
That's cool.
So clearly, Claire, caring for your environment has long been a part of your own vernacular, if you like. Your mother is a botanist, as I understand it, and your father is a biological researcher. So what was your childhood like?
We had a wonderful vegetable garden and greenhouse and growing tomatoes in the greenhouse. And
in Brooklyn?
No, I grew up in England. And lots of hiking and camping. A lot of contact with nature growing up. I mean, my mum would take me on these fungal forays where we'd go in the woods and look for mushrooms and,
lots of
fun stuff.
Yeah. And then you decided to become an architect?
Yep. Green architecture wasn't really talked about when I was studying. It was a nerdy thing that only one guy was interested in the class, and I was hesitant to...
You didn't like it?
I didn't want to be nerdy. I mean, I want to be cool and artistic.
Right.
So I was hesitant to kind of engage at the beginning. But then when I started, I think my first project was like, hey, could we pierce the walls of this sealed building that has sick building syndrome? And
what's sick building syndrome?
That was a 70s thing where they sealed buildings so tightly to save energy that people got sick from all the... formaldehyde that the furnishings and things are giving off.
Oh my God.
And the sealants and just bad chemicals.
So you learned about that and then you were like, we'll put
some
holes in this building?
Let's bring in some fresh air using solar panels to do so. And it just made me think, hey, you could really design buildings to work with nature and the larger environment rather than be sealed off from them.
So green architecture, for people who don't know, and I'm talking about myself, for our ignorant listeners, but like when I think of it, I think of like, yes, solar panels, maybe like beehives on the roof or like gardens or like those hanging walls of grass. And can you just give us a quick primer in what green architecture is?
I mean, to me, green or sustainable, there's so many words, restorative architecture, doesn't harm the planet in its making, its operation, or its end of life either. So it doesn't use a lot of fossil fuels for its energy. It doesn't create a lot of waste within it. The building materials can be reused after its use. It's just a building that fits in, but it also has to be of benefit to society as well.
Okay, got it.
So Claire, now you're co-chairing the American Institute of Architects Committee on the Environment, is that right?
The New York chapter, yes.
What did green buildings mean 20 years ago, and have those standards progressed through today?
Definitely. So the Committee on the Environment, it's like a voluntary organization of architects and people in the building professions who care about sustainable buildings. We educate other architects, but we also work on policy. So at the moment, we're consulting and giving input to the mayor's office and council members who are trying to do this bill to reduce energy use in existing buildings drastically. Mm-hmm. They want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from buildings 80% by 2050.
The biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in New York City may not be what first comes to mind. The answer is this: buildings, of which New York City has more than any other city in the country, and it's why there's been a call to reduce their emissions.
That's incredible. I think that's the kind of science and research we need to bring into cities that are urbanizing at the rates that India is going through right now. And as a nation, not only are we dealing with how to house folks coming into cities and cities taking over villages, but also what is the impact of this level of construction that's going to happen on the climate. And yeah, there is, no, you know, there are a few things that are happening in terms of some policies, but not enough. And it'd be so amazing for someone like you to come to Delhi for us to kind of have this conversation here.
In a way, building on that too, you know, we know that rapid urbanization is creating highly inefficient design of buildings and infrastructures. And net zero buildings are on several aspirational lists for cities. But what does it mean for a building to be net zero? And could New York City itself be a net zero city?
I definitely worked on some net zero buildings, including one skyscraper. But the problem is, to be net zero in a dense city like New York City is you have to have enough solar resource. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the middle of a load of other skyscrapers, there's no way you can be net zero. You can reduce the amount of energy you use as much as possible and generate as much power from sunlight as you can.
But you're in the shadow of these.
You're in the shadow of other buildings. And yeah, we want density. So net zero in terms of a building scale is not something I believe in for dense cities. So the whole lot of work I've done with waste has made me think we need to use buildings more intensely. Mm. Even that co-working space. If that restaurant wasn't used in the day, they'd use less energy. But we have to be using our spaces intensely so we can build less.
Right.
But net zero in the terms of a city, yes. New York City should be just using renewable energy created either in the city or close by it.
It's so fascinating to even imagine net zero cities, particularly in countries where cities are, you know, in process of being built. So imagine if we could take these insights and be part of the planning process with this outlook. I mean, it could change the world, literally. Mm-hmm. But Claire, also, so how does one go from greening buildings to biomimicry? And please tell us what biomimicry exactly is.
Sure. So biomimicry is really looking at nature and how natural systems work and thinking how they could influence man-made systems and our designs. Some of the most simple biomimic inventions are things like Velcro. That was like when a guy went for a walk and got those burrs on his clothes, and he was like, wow, this is a really strong attachment mechanism, and it can go on and off. We could design that for our shoes, for example.
Yeah.
But on a system level, like for waste, if ecosystems, they don't have any waste. They have these circular resource loops. Whereas our systems, 90% of the materials we mine out of the ground and make into bottles and everything, they're right. back in a landfill or a dump within 6 months.
Right.
And so there's this rapid extraction of materials, which pollutes the environment. The making of all our materials pollutes, and then the dumping of it does. And looking how we can do that differently was part of the Zero Waste Design Guidelines. So if you look how ecosystems develop to get those circular resource loops, it's all sorts of things like they have really good collaborative relationships between different species, and they have feedback loops, which means they are always evaluating what they're doing. And that's the kind of thing we're starting to do with energy, but not waste. So
Claire, we've seen a lot in the news recently about how the UN itself is embracing the idea maybe of floating cities.
The United Nations is considering a futuristic solution to the risk of coastal flooding from climate change, a sustainable floating city. The company Oceanics is constructing a prototype expected to be open to the public within just months.
Is it true that you contributed zero waste research to that project?
Yes. Yeah, that was a really interesting project to work on.
Oh, tell us about it.
Well, Oceanics was set up by Mark Collins, who was a tourism minister in French Polynesia. And many of the islands there are going to be underwater, and people are having to relocate or are building really tall walls around the whole island. And he was desperately looking for solutions for these people. And that is how he came to the idea of the floating city. And then he got funding to design one of these floating cities, and he came to us to do the zero waste concept. You're going to grow your own food, package it in stuff that can be washed and have no disposable anything, just have all reusables and wash them all. And then it helped us think about how you can design spaces so that you don't have to have such big spaces, and you can have shared spaces, and you can lease everything you might need. Like if you need a drill or an oboe.
those are the things that come to mind. That's on your list today.
You could just borrow it. You don't need to own it and then have to dispose of it.
Right.
When we were developing the zero waste plan for the floating city, we looked at the tiffin lunch system that is used in India, in Mumbai. The Dabawalas have all these reusable lunch containers. There's a lot we were learning from the way things are done elsewhere as well.
Do you mean those stacks of lunch boxes?
Yeah, the stacks of the metal ones. And it's a really, really, really complex system. Like, I don't know how many lunches are delivered to how many people. I mean, the logistics of it is amazing.
Yeah.
And they all get back and washed.
Indians do love to reuse. Traditionally, we fix everything. You can get pretty much anything fixed in India and keep using products for a long time. So that traditional knowledge, you're right, it absolutely exists. And we need to sort of remind cultures of that knowledge and not be swayed by some of the more sort of consumption-led economies that are so easily available around us. But you're absolutely right. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
But Claire, isn't this exactly the world we need to be imagining?
Yes.
Where we're not having so much production and consumption, production, consumption. We reuse, we recycle, we have a circular economy.
And then there's loads of social implications too. We can have community compost gardens where people bring their food waste and they grow food and create soil. And
you can play the oboe while you're composting, and you can cycle over and give the three-year-old your bike.
But it builds relationships, which is really important in a city.
Yes, yes. Waste is a very different field from energy. I really have seen that. It builds a lot of relationships. There's a load of women working in solutions to waste. It all seems to be female little startups. Yep.
So do you think zero waste is a climate issue as well as an environmental one?
Definitely. Just as one example, 40% of our food is wasted. And there's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions in growing the food, in transporting the food, in cooling the food while it's transported. And then the food waste normally goes to landfill, where it decomposes anaerobically and it gives off methane, which, as we know, is a really bad greenhouse gas. So, yes.
And here in New York, there's no local landfills. The city trucks its waste.
As far as South Carolina in big 18-wheelers. I mean, it's crazy.
Oh, my God.
I think that was kind of my midlife crisis. I was asking, as an architect, how do I better separate food waste in my building? And there were no answers. So I was like, oh, well, every architect's not going to figure this out for themselves. And that started the process of developing the guidelines. And they've had really great reception. And now we're trying to take them to other cities around the world. And
yeah. So then that's why we love having you on the show, because it's mothers of invention. So it's people like you who spot these gaps and think like, well, with my background, what can I do and where can this, you know, get us? It's very exciting to talk to you.
Claire, it's wonderful to see the creativity of you and so many others. And it's further proof that we don't need all to be scientists to do something about changing climate. Your efforts are really very inspirational.
Oh, thank you.
Claire, thank you so much. I think your work is just so inspirational for cities like Delhi and others in this part of the world. And the idea of circular economy really hits home as well. How do people get involved with what you do? How do we kind of transfer this knowledge to some of the cities that really need it?
Well, we just set up the website centerforzerowastedesign.org. I have another consultancy called thinkwoven.com. Because everything is woven together and influences.
Yeah, that's nice.
That's lovely.
I like that.
Yeah. Closer to home as well, you've had a big impact on Thamali, who's our producer sitting out in the booth. She took out her landfill trash only 5 times last year because she heard you speak on zero waste at the New York Center for Architecture.
So. Go Thamali. Thank you. That was a great conversation. Thank you, Mary, and thank you, Richa.
Bye, Claire. Thank you.
Thank you, Claire. You're formidable. Well done. Keep it up.
So, Richa, thanks so much for joining us. Can you let me and our listeners know where to find and follow you?
Sure. Please follow Help Delhi Breathe's page on social media. It's called Pollution Solution, at Pollution Solution, and Twitter handle at Help Delhi Breathe, as well as helpdelhibreathe.net.
You've been a wonderful mother of invention. It's been a great pleasure to listen to you. And Delhi is such an important city, a major, major city. So good luck in your hard work and in your ideas and in your inventiveness. It's really great to listen.
Thank you so much. It was really great to be part of this conversation.
Well, that's a wrap for this week. We know you can't help but love our excellent little show, so come and tell us all about it on our social media. We're always delighted to know who you'd like to hear about next, since this show is your show too. So, what are you waiting for? Nominate the climate hero you'd like to hear in the Mothers of Invention studio. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The handle is @MothersInvent.
Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society, and it's made possible by the support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowd funders.
Our series producer is Thamali Kodikara. The executive producers are Jess Search and Beatty Finzi. Our audio producer and mixer is Anne Pope, and Jada Sande is our superhero researcher. Interviewing Mayor Aki Sawyer in Paris was Sarah Rodriguez. Our climate expert consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is Water Fountain by TuneYards, with the good permission of 4AD and Marriage Records, and additional music is from Poddington Bear.